over to you, James, and I should leave you absolutely opposite. And
so you take the position I could have written on this as far as I know. We have no jurisdiction in the conflict.
That's what I understand, John.
Okay.
I understand the way this court has to assist in the reason for it is so that you can tell the Court of Civil Appeal what the law is, and that you can correct dicta, such as in Watts, where Mr. Lilly totally hangs his hat on. This court has said in many cases, and I would call the court to attention to
the sample of this dicta that we have. You're objecting to the terms of law? I could ask Ben Ashley Holden, maybe.
Yeah, I think this court conveys its decision on what the court says. The dicta is simply not regardless of controlling, not particularly persuasive. That this court has said that. And there is a diversity of opinion from the Court of Civil Appeals. I do think that it came from the district, yes, sir. And I think the court brings up a good point there. I think it is an important enough decision that this court must be wrong so that our court, the little kids involved, know how to submit issues. That what in itself to the continuity and status quo is important. And I think that every judge on the bench would agree to that. And by changing the statute in 75, they said, if you show a material change of circumstance in the child, it's just a law that the parent would. If you show a change of circumstance, which, if the circumstance is any different, that's a change of circumstance. It could even be better for that matter. But I don't see how the possessive conservator can make it harmful to leave the child in an environment that he's been in for some time.
That's a good book, but it is an easy point that the child begins to have to observe the unorthodox family life, minus living lady. Is there any difference if a man with a living man?
Yes, that would be a change of circumstances if he got older. And if the court, in fact, gave custody at that time to a man with a living lady, I think the court cool doing that all around the same
time. Well, if there's a lot of suggestions, you've got two points.
Yes,
the woman's got a living man, he's got a living woman, you've got to take one of the other.
Well, I thought you said you're living a man with a man.
Well, I am, but
you're referring to a homosexual
situation. Yeah, the court has got to make a choice to begin with, and we're serving the world.
But we have two homosexuals. Mm-hmm. And then the lady later changes from being a homosexual.
The point is, there has to be a change in the contained parent, the possessory parent, before you can relitigate the sex. That's the basic problem, right?
No, sir, I think the basic problem is that if they would change the circumstances of the child, or the custody of the parent, he's not here. I'm saying that the
child is innocent of the newborn baby. He's
but then they would change the circumstances with regard to the child. If the jury hears evidence that the possessor can play the part, it's just one of them, and the jury's mind, that in fact makes the peculiar change of circumstance with regard to the child, and I think this is just supposed to work here. And the jury can say, we see a material change of circumstance with regard to the child. So they answer, yes, we do. But a change of circumstance with regard to the child. Now you get to the second issue. There is that change by keeping the child now as a protocol and jury to the child.
Counsel, let's ask about the child in this case. What does the record show in this case? Does it show that the child is out of control, that the child is unhappy, that the child's status has changed? Well, in other words, a change is to the child. If the father is misbehaving, that might reflect upon the child. Now, does this record show that there's been any change as to the child by reason of the situation?
No, ma'am. It shows that the child does well and see that the father is a good daddy, that the child is emotionally okay, that he's never left alone, that he visits with his mother a great deal. The jury asked if they could take away the invitation of the mother. He hadn't tried to terminate. It was obvious that this was simply a battleground. The child was in great hands, sir. The daddy is a secret heir. And this really tasting the terror. The man had a girlfriend. He didn't live there. He stayed over there. I don't say that I approve of it. I think that when the child gets older, if he continues in that situation, that is a material change of circumstance. A 2-year-old child doesn't know if somebody's living there or not married. A 10 or 12-year-old does. They can get to that threshold issue. If Mr. Jones is living with some lady, that he was living there till he was 4, and his child 15, that's a material change of circumstance. The psychiatrist will tell you that. The child does well. There is no testimony to J.P. Jones of anything that's superb for. He has cooperated with his patients. The record is completely. It's unbelievable he's just a good child. He did have a girlfriend. You still have a girlfriend. To my knowledge, anyway, this case has been going on for some time. This is a typical case where you go to the parent. He says, oh, I feel terrible. I've got to go for my child. I don't care about my child. I want to prove it to myself. And legislature says, no, ma'am, or no, sir. We're going to make it so tough on you to do it, but we're going to try to keep you out of the courthouse. Quit breaking litigants and flooding our courts with serious lawsuits. That's the reason that it should be so difficult. It should be so easy. Fine. Then if you can show positive improvement, fine. But just because mom or daddy improves their situation, there's no change that could reflect on the child. Mr. Lilliard, Mrs. Crawford, one, said that the judge knew what Mr. Lilliard was talking about. How do you know what a judge knows if the record doesn't show? Mr. Lilliard said, of course, domestic relations, we ought to just try it by chance. I disagree with that, John. If you're supposed to have some rules, if you have the rules, why not follow them? Well, let's just say we don't have any rules, and that we can submit special issues any way we want to, or that we don't have to object, or we can try a case as we please, and then come over here to the Supreme Court and say, y'all knew what I was talking about, and you know Judge Bill knew what I was talking about. So don't hold it against me and my client because I didn't try the lawsuit the way you told me by your rules that I have to try.
I invite counsel to read the old case of Whitman versus Whitman.
I do so.
I realize that it is a specimen.
I realize that.
Crawford referred to the Anderson case without admission. I had it in the outline and ran out of time. He neglected to tell the court that that was tried before the code was changed. He also neglected to say in the Anderson case that public policy requires a high degree of stability for a child. All the cases that they cited, with the exception of Watts, are not in point. Watts is only in point with regard to this. I would consider asking to rule with regard to points 1 and 2. We need to know where we stand. Only this court can tell us. But if, in fact, the court disagrees with 1 and 2, I think that the court should make lawyers try cases by the rules, and it should hold that Mr. Lilliard didn't deserve his objection. I would urge the court to reverse the 14th court on all 3 points. Let us
us know how we're supposed to hold the state of
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written brief and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.
The reason is that if these facts are not known and the debt is foreclosed, without the knowledge of the linked factors, for instance, if it was foreclosed in December, they're not really delinquent, but they're due. And I don't know what burden we have to put on the windfall. That may be the court's reason, and I may be the decision for this, so we'll make the law in that direction in the near future. But the position today is, and the reason I make that statement so it's clear, I think I disagree with Mr. Johnson, that I believe that if we know of these indebtedness, it is part of our indebtedness in the foreclosure. It's not so. Now, what happens to be the first one for you, the foreclosure? Are you saying the liability for the taxes you pay, you discovered the taxes after the foreclosure, and so therefore he's personally liable? Is that the provision?
Yes.
Or then what makes it, is it the deed of trust that makes him personally liable?
It's our position that the documents that are involved in the transaction are what create the liability for the taxes. The transaction sale was didn't mention, but did create the agreement that there will be no personal liability for the repayment of the purchase price. Then you should note the four notes we had and the four deeds of trust. And it's our position that after the foreclosure, the taxes are due, which we had to pay to protect our ownership, that were owed by the owner at the time they were assessed. And there's another company that who the taxes were assessed again, and he owed them according to the form. Now, let me point this out before I forget, the statute Mr. Johnson quoted.
You're about to get to a place where I thought you disagreed with the counsel's respondent, but to be the first to foreclose, it goes out the window.
What goes out the window?
Whatever then to be the first.
That was not the question. What happened to it when it was foreclosed?
Purpose of it having been performed, it was from the fiduciary or something. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. I hope that's not what the court thinks.
That's what I was hearing you say.
No, Mr. Campbell, I don't believe that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, are you asking me, are these terms all just null and void after foreclosure? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, what happens to the deed itself? What is the legal effect of the deed itself after foreclosure?
Well, it's like you pay it off, in my opinion. It's just like you file a legal lien.
Well, it's not doing on the deed itself, though. Once the liability you think is clear by virtue of that deed itself, which went out the window when you foreclosed.
But we're suing on a pre-existing debt that was not paid by the owner through the tax that were assessed against.
What debt? What debt?
The taxes that were assessed against the property at the time he left Merck on the owner's property.
I'm still counsel for the first case, say that he is using the deed of trust as a separate instrument and suing on the promise expressed in the deed of trust. Promise to pay taxes.
I agree with that. I'm saying to you that there's no rent on the property after the foreclosure. I'm not saying that the terms of the deed of trust and the agreement of the parties to pay a debt that was created during the existence is not still there. That's what we're saying.
So you're just saying that the land goes away with foreclosure, but the contractual provisions do not.
Yes, sir. I don't believe there's any lien against the property. I take the same position that they were talking about, that we're not trying to take the tax in it. And I feel assured that my opponent will go into the steps of taking vision of the taxing authority to collect it rather than through personal. But we don't feel that we have to do that. And we feel that under terms of due trust, we have the right through all the taxes that we have to pay. Let me mention, if I may, the statute upon which Justice Robertson wrote his opinion has been repealed and have been repealed. One of them has been repealed. The new property tax code has replaced it. And accepting the language of the property tax code, the language is simply something that is the owner of the property. have to go looking for the under the fact. The
council, the deed of trust, I'm sure, has provisions that the mortgagor will maintain the property in good repair at all times. He doesn't do that. And by reason of his failure to keep the property in good repair, he breaches the terms of the security interest, so they proceed to foreclose under the deed of trust, and they do foreclose. Then 6 months later, the mortgagee institutes the suit for the cost of repairs. Would he recover?
Yes, I believe.
This would be consistent with your position.
Yes, sir. I'm not believe the limitation period might be involved. I don't know whether it would be.
I'm assuming that there's no limitations.
Sir, I believe
trying to understand where we're going on this.
Now, counsel for the respondent in the fire case read an example paragraph to Greg Starwood in which he said that he had no personal liability to any of the public in Huntsville. I think if we had that line in the deed of trust, then, yes, he could foreclose for keeping the property in good repair, but I don't believe he could sue after foreclosure to collect those repairs. But absent that line, that limited language, I believe that unless the type language offset the funded language is no conflict, and I don't see the conflict on it. But that still would be enforceable action for cost repairs or in this case for the tax. The attempt by Justice Robertson to distinguish the two cases, I don't believe it's well taken, and I must take that position, obviously, I wouldn't be here. The Texas Center team makes a function without either clear reading of the trust of wood or a distinction of the cases of sight, but I must urge that the rent holders of wood were not volunteers. They come under the cases would say that the relationship between the landholder and the owner was one of contractual authority to pay the taxes or by request, meaning that if requested by the owner to pay the taxes, could have done so and still maintained. Or if we have contractual authority, meaning the original deed of trust executed by the party. That seems to be a very difficult distinction, and it takes more than one or two reasons where the stone is important trying to come up with that distinction. But it's there, and that is the distinction that we see. I will reserve my other comments. I don't understand that, but I'm 4 miles above. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take the brief recess.
Thank
I'm
May the police report, I will refer the court to the respondent, police penalty one. In that appendix, we have all the contracts, due trust, and promise from others for them to discuss today. I also have an aid that I've brought along with me, and that I'll use this purpose to emphasize this information before at the appropriate time. I would note in this way that in listening to the argument of the petitioner, we perhaps do not have as much disagreement as I initially thought in reading the brief. First of all, I think that if someone has knowledge of taxes and then is required to pay those taxes at the foreclosure sale or included in indebtedness on the foreclosure sale, that an individual that would be required to do that and thus extinguish the indebtedness would then not be allowed because of some supposed lack of knowledge after the deed of trust has been used for foreclosure to step in and begin to using that same deed of trust. Now, when we talk about knowledge in this case, I think that it should be pointed out by Justice Scheer. First of all, if someone is defaulted on deed of trust because they cannot make payments under it, I think you're put on inquiry notice that the same individual may not be able to make the tax payments and probably has not made the tax payments on the plan. Now remember, we're talking about principles of subrogation here. Subrogation being an equitable remedy. Someone who's free from the right or fails to take advantage of the simple process of going to the tax assessor and determining whether or not taxes are due on the area should not be allowed to come in under the principle of subrogation and equitable remedy and to enforce a right for payment of those taxes. I think there are three areas of law here generally that we're talking about. The first being that of subrogation, second taxes, and finally we're talking about contracts. And probably the contract is here, at least that I feel, that will decide this case. And we talked about subrogation, and I sat and listened to the first case, and I became somewhat confused in my reading and researching this case, and particularly in 55 M through second. It's my understanding the majority rule in this country, and the rule that follows here in Texas regarding the foreclosure of the bar to action for taxes, is that taxes, together with the amount due on the mortgage, constitute a single and indivisible demand, and that cannot collect the taxes separate of the deed of trust or the mortgage instrument. And secondly, that when you satisfy the mortgage, this cancels and terminates all liability on the part of the mortgage or to the mortgage use. That is my understanding to be the majority rule in the United States, and it is also the rule here in Texas. Now, we talked about the Tiller case and the Victorian case, and I think there are good backgrounds here to tell us that under the doctrine of subrogation, the respondent, in this case, myself, should be entitled to have the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals affirmed. If those cases hold under the doctrine of subrogation, whether before or after foreclosure has occurred, that the mortgage used to not been condemned and sue out a separate suit to make a person personally liable for any taxes that may have been due but that were not paid by the mortgagor. This makes sense, I think, under several things. One, the mortgagor is the person who has lost the land, who has made payments on the land. All that money has been lost. Therefore, this has gone back to the mortgagee. The mortgagee now has his land back. He has any money that was made in the form of payments and also without payment on the land. So economically speaking, the mortgagee is probably in a better position after foreclosure has occurred. Secondly, any rights that would arise or that would entitle someone such as the mortgagee to take a personal judgment to taxes have been extinguished. The deed of trust is granted in this right has been already presented either in a lawsuit or through a foreclosure proceeding. This particular instrument is gone. You no longer
have it in your contract whereby you agree to pay the taxes?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. It's contained in the deed of trust. The particular covenant and cited in the Court of Civil Appeals decision states that and they're talking first also about insurance, and it may say, said taxes may be paid by the legal holder of said note, and some circumstances shall be one, a demand obligation, and become part of the debt thereby secured, and shall draw interest at the rate of 10% per annum, and it goes on, and says the entire principal indebtedness may be pledged to and collected in any manner provided in this instrument or provided by law. However, I point out that immediately above this particular language, in typewritten terms, is a statement that anything herein to the contrary notwithstanding, the undersigned shall have no personal liability for the payment of the note secured hereby. And in the event of default, the holder of said note shall have the mortgage property alone as security for the payment of said note. Now, I would go back and I would cite the Supreme Court case of Mann versus Christman, Ubaran, the general rule of construction, the typewritten clauses and contracts have preference over printed material. Printed material in this case being the statement as the taxes to become a demand obligation part of the debt secured, and then going and looking at the typewritten clause which says anything herein non-returned. I think it clearly excludes any obligation, any for personal liability on any taxes in our particular case. I do not disagree with the statement that under Article 7151, the true owner of the land is responsible for paying the tax. I don't think this is a question or issue here. If you have the state of Texas standing on file, obviously the state of Texas is going to be able to collect both against the loan and also against the fine. But that does not give a person in petitioner to the right to step in and to assert the super lien if you want to call. And again, the Kelly cases clearly have indicated that this is not something that is going to be granted to someone who is in the shoes of a mortgage degree. 7345A does provide a specific manner in which the tax lien can be transferred. And I cited that, but if a person were to look at it, it tells the tax collector exactly what needs to be done. He has a written authorization, he fills out a form noting that it's been transferred, and transfers the lien of the state to the individual who seeks to be, let's say, subrogated to the payment of tax. Now, cases surrounding this will tell that really all this does is tell the tax collector how he's supposed to go about transferring this lien. It doesn't provide the only method of an individual stepping into the shoes of the state and then they tax them and subrogated to the rights of the state. But I think what it does point out is, number one, if it's truly the intent of the parties that they are going to be liable for the payment of taxes, then the method of which to do it is specifically set forth by the legislature. As the petition in this case follows the procedure, we didn't use it for this court today, because it's been clear that he has been required for some of them to pay the taxes. This procedure wasn't followed, and that's the reason why we're here today.
If that procedure had been followed, would that have imposed personal liability?
Yes, Your Honor. The particular procedure does is require a very definite statement to be given by the individual who you're going to make the tax payment for. He has to sign a specific authorization setting forth the fact that he allows this person to do it, that he agrees that the lien was supposed to be transferred and withheld against him. Well, that wasn't the procedure that he used here. So I think what we do then is we go back and we're going to have to take a look at the instrument and the laws of construction and find the support before. We're going to basically what we do is we look at the surrounding circumstances to then determine the intent of the party and then apply the pertinent rules of construction to the contract. And I'd like to first point to support the contract of sale, because since the contract of sale is a surrounding circumstance, and that it's an instrument that was used and executed at the same time. And if the court's permission, I'd like to step to the aid for a minute. If you look at the contract of sale, clearly stated in there is that the note will be without personal liability. If you look at the promissory note, they'll have no personal liability for the payment of this note. They'll have the mortgage property alone as security for the payment of this note. And then we come to the deed of trust. think this is probably the most explicit clause that's contained in that entire deed of trust. The rest is denoted as just a form that you can go down and buy at any of the legal stationery stores that are located around the Castle Building and other parts of the state. But these people knew what they wanted to do. I think when you look at the transaction, it's apparent that the individuals who were seeking to purchase this land as investment, they were seeking to go out, to put their money out. If they lost that money, that was it. That was going to be the end of it. They went to great lengths to put in the contract of sale, the promissory note, and then finally the deed of trust. That there was no personal liability. If they lost the money that they put out thus far, fine and good. That would be it. That would be the end. But there would be nothing more. That's what the contract is for, and that was their intent. And it should not be tripped up or their intent burned or deviated by some small printed words in a form contract. Now, the deed of trust goes on. In addition to this very striking statement, there are other statements that again show no personal liability. Again, with the court's permission, I'll step to the page. Here again, we talk about what happens in the event of default. The holder of said note shall have the mortgage, the property, a loan, and security for the payment of said note. You run through the other terms in it and come down and we talked about it. The payment of taxes or insurance and it will become part of the debt hereby secured. And then finally, we get into the area ahead. Petitioner seeks to hang his hat to become the testimony and to be entitled to either the right of preservation or to be entitled to personal liability judgment against the respondent in the state. And it's evident again from the writing and numerous clauses that are contained in the various instruments and the petitioner here in the deed of trust that there would be no personal liability in this particular case. I would also point out that in this particular clause, when we look at what they seek to hang their hat on is, number one, that will become part of the debt. Now, if we look at it, this means that it will become part of the debt of security. Now, well, what is the debt? The debt is the promissory note. If the promissory note is not paid, what is part of the recourse? The recourse is to go ahead and to foreclose against the land. There will be no personal liability. That's one thing they can do. Or they can then make it part of the debt itself and simply continue it as part of the indebtedness. And then if the future payments are not made, again they have the right of foreclosure. Now that's what they may do. But once they foreclose, this terminates any rights that this deed of trust has and any remedies that they can provide to them. Therefore, in this particular case, they would be denied the right of approaching judgment. We talked about, Justice Garwood had some questions on trust and using in this particular industry. And I think we're all sitting here, we're very much aware that land speculation and using land as an attempt to get around the perils of inflation is very prevalent here today. And that people are going out, they're putting their money into things such as land. That if a person is a professional, a person or someone who perhaps has a small stake and is very concerned about keeping what he has and maybe attempting to make that grow a little bit, but to guard what he has presently. Now, you can do that through the use of an old personal liability note. You may go out and purchase land that these people did as part of the joint venture. And by putting in these clauses, feel that you're safely protected beyond what you've already extended. The court would say that no, that the contract of sale, the promissory note, the deed of trust, all the language, no matter what's written in here, the makers of this note will not have personal liability. So they say, well, no, this could go beyond it. But the mortgage deed could go beyond the land itself and dispute personal judgment of these people. It would completely alienate an entire group of investors or an entire group of people in the whole state of Texas. People who have gone out, have invested in various land transactions with knowledge that, yes, they could lose what they put out, but with also the supposed knowledge that that would be all that they would lose. That would not be the case if the court was a rule against the respondent in this case. At this time, are there any justice issues that have any questions in this particular area?
There's a clear argument on this position. Do a better argument from the court.
The more views and never see the person for the back end. Yet they turn around the next turn and say that the wood cake is different from the other cases that they cite. We respect your request that the court reverse the second one for the court of two and all things affirm the decision according to the court.
Thank you, John. I'd like to compliment counsel both these cases, but you didn't need many questions.